Disc 3.
The men were as hardened physically as it was possible for human beings to be. Not even professional boxers or football players were in better shape. They were disciplined, prepared to carry out orders instantly and unquestioningly. They were experts in the use of their own weapon, knowledgeable in the use of other weapons, familiar with and capable of operating German weapons. They could operate radios, knew a variety of hand signals, could recognize various smoke signals. They were skilled in tactics, whether the problem was attacking a battery or a blockhouse or a trench system or a hill defended by machine guns. Each man knew the duties and responsibilities of a squad or platoon leader and was prepared to assume those duties if necessary. They knew how to blow bridges, how to render artillery pieces inoperative. They could set up a defensive position in an instant. They could live in the field, sleep in a foxhole, march all day and through the night. They knew and trusted each other. Within easy company, they had made the best friends they had ever had or would ever have. They were prepared to die for each other. More important, they were prepared to kill for each other. They were ready. But of course, going into combat for the first time is an ultimate experience for which one can never be fully ready. It is anticipated for years in advance. It is a test that produces anxiety, eagerness, tension, fear of failure, anticipation. There is a mystery about the thing, heightened by the fact that those who have done it cannot put into words what it is like, how it feels, except that getting shot at and shooting to kill produce extraordinary emotional reactions. No matter how hard you train, nor however realistic the training, no one can ever be fully prepared for the intensity of the real thing. And so the men of Easy Company left Altborn full of self-confidence and full of trepidation. Easy's marshalling area in southwestern England, about 10 miles from the coast, was an open field beside the airstrip at a pottery. The company lived in pyramidal tents. "Our standards of living went up considerably," Webster wrote. "We stuffed ourselves at the hospitable mess hall, a wall tent. Want some more, boys? Just help yourselves. Take all you want." On such luxuries as fried chicken, fruit cocktail, white bread with lots of butter, the realization that we were being fattened for the slaughter didn't stop us from going back for seconds. Troops wearing German uniforms and carrying German weapons roamed constantly through the marshalling area to familiarize the men with what the enemy looked like and what weapons they carried. On June 2nd, the company officers got their briefings from former E Company officers, 1st Lieutenant Nixon, now 2nd Battalion S2, and Captain Hester, S3. On sand tables, they showed terrain features, houses, roads, dunes, and the rest, and on maps. Nixon and Hester explained that Easy would be dropping near Sainte-Marie-du-Mont, about 10 kilometers south of Sainte-Marie-Église, with the objective of killing the German garrison in the village and seizing the exit at Causeway No. 2, the road coming up from the coast just north of the village of Poupeville. The 3rd Platoon was given the task of blowing up a communications line leading inland from La Madeleine. The detailed information given out by Nixon and Hester and by other intelligence officers briefing other companies was truly amazing. They passed around aerial photographs of the DZ that showed not only roads, buildings, and the like, but even foxholes. One member of the 506th recalled that his company was told that the German commandant at its objective Saint-Combe-du-Mont owned a white horse and was going with a French schoolteacher who lived on a side street just 2 buildings away from a German gun emplacement that was zeroed in on Causeway No. 1. He took his dog for a walk every evening at 2000 hours. Each officer had to learn the company mission by heart, know his own and every other platoon's mission to the most minute detail, and be able to draw a map of the whole area by memory. One point was made very clear: that the Germans relied less on their fixed coastal defenses than on their ability to counterattack. Mobile reserve units would start hitting the 4th Infantry wherever its units threatened to make it across the causeways. The briefers, therefore, impressed strongly on the officers that regardless of where their platoons were or how many of their men they had managed to collect, if they spotted German units moving toward the causeways, they should fire upon them with everything they had. Even a five-minute delay thus imposed on the Germans could mean the difference between success and failure at Utah Beach. The importance of each mission was likewise emphasized most effectively. Winters said, "I had the feeling that we were going in there and win the whole damn thing ourselves. It was our baby." On June 3rd, Winters and the other platoon leaders walked their men through the briefing tent, showing them the sand tables and maps, telling them what they had learned. Sergeant Guarnieri needed to use the latrine. He grabbed a jacket and strolled over to the facility. Sitting down, he put his hand in a pocket and pulled out a letter. It was addressed to Sergeant Martin. Guarnieri had taken Martin's jacket by mistake, but Guarnieri read it anyway. Martin's wife was the author. They had been married in Georgia in 1942, and Mrs. Martin knew most of the members of the company. She wrote, "Don't tell Bill, Guarnieri, but his brother was killed in Cassino, Italy. You can't imagine the anger I felt," Guarnieri said later. "I swore that when I got to Normandy, there ain't no German gonna be alive. I was like a maniac. When they sent me into France, they turned a killer loose, a wild man." On June 4th, Easy was issued its ammunition, $10 worth of new French francs just printed in Washington, an escape kit containing a silk map of France, a tiny brass compass, and a hacksaw. The men were given an American flag to sew on the right sleeves of their jump jackets. Officers removed their insignia from their uniforms and painted vertical stripes on the back of their helmets. NCOs had horizontal stripes. Everyone was given the verbal challenge, flash, the password, thunder, and the response, welcome. They were also given small metal dime store crickets for alternative identification. One squeeze, click-clack, to be answered by two, click-clack, click-clack. The men spent the day cleaning weapons, sharpening knives, adjusting the parachutes, checking the equipment over and over, chain-smoking cigarettes. Many of the men shaved their heads or got mohawk haircuts, bald on each side with a 1 or 2 inch strip of short hair running from the forehead to the back of the neck. Privates Forrest Guth and Joseph Liebgott did the cutting at 15 cents per man. Colonel Sink came around, saw the haircutting going on, smiled, and said, "I forgot to tell you. Some weeks ago, we were officially notified that the Germans are telling French civilians that the Allied invasion forces would be led by American paratroopers, all of them convicted felons and psychopaths, easily recognized by the fact that they shave their heads, or nearly so." First Lieutenant Raymond Schmitz decided to ease the tension with some physical activity. He challenged Winters to a boxing match. "Come on, Winters, let's go out there behind the tents and box." "No, go away." Schmitz kept after him. Finally, he said, "Okay, let's wrestle." "Damn it, enough. You've been egging me long enough. Let's go." Winters had been a wrestler in college. He took Schmitz down immediately, but he threw him too hard. Schmitz suffered 2 cracked vertebrae, went to the hospital, and did not get to go to Normandy. His assistant leader of the 3rd Platoon, 2nd Lieutenant Robert Matthews, took his place, with Sergeant Lipton as his second in command. The rest of that day and night, on up to the time the men strapped on their parachutes, Winters had a constant line of troopers asking him, with smiles on their faces, to break their arms or crack their vertebrae. General Taylor circulated among the men. He told them, "Give me 3 days and nights of hard fighting, then you will be relieved." That sounded good. 3 days and 3 nights, Winters thought to himself, "I can take that." Taylor also said that when the C-47s crossed the coastline of France, he wanted every man to stand up. If a trooper got hit by flak, he wanted him to be standing and take it like a man. There was a point to the order that went beyond bravado. If a plane got hit, the men hooked up and ready to jump would stand some chance of getting out. Taylor told Malarkey's platoon to fight with knives until daylight and don't take any prisoners. That night, June 4th, the company got an outstanding meal. Steak, green peas, mashed potatoes, white bread, ice cream, coffee, in unlimited quantities. It was their first ice cream since arriving in England 9 months earlier. Sergeant Martin remembered being told, "When you get ice cream for supper, you know that's the night." But a terrific wind was blowing, and just as the men were preparing to march to their C-47s, they were told to stand down. Eisenhower had postponed the invasion because of the adverse weather. Easy went to a wall tent to see a movie. Gordon remembered that it was Mr. Lucky, starring Cary Grant and Lorraine Day. Sergeants Lipton and Elmer Murray, the company's operations sergeant, skipped the movie. They spent the evening discussing different combat situations that might occur and how they would handle them. By the afternoon of June 5th, the wind had died down, the sky cleared a bit. Someone found cans of black and green paint. Men began to daub their faces in imitation of the Sioux at the Little Bighorn, drawing streaks of paint down their noses and foreheads. Others took charcoal and blackened their faces. At 20:30 hours, the men lined up by the plane load, 18 to a group, and marched off to the hangars. Nobody sang. Nobody cheered, Webster wrote. It was like a death march. Winters remembered going past some British anti-aircraft units stationed at the field. And that was the first time I'd ever seen any real emotion from a Limey. They actually had tears in their eyes. At the hangars, each jumpmaster was given two packs of papers, containing an order of the day from Eisenhower and a message from Colonel Sink to pass around to the men. "Tonight is the night of nights," said Sinks. "May God be with each of you fine soldiers." Eisenhower's began, "Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking." In addition to the exhortations, the jump masters passed around air sickness pills. Who thought of the pills is a mystery. Why they were passed around, an even greater mystery, as air sickness had seldom been a problem. Something else was new. The British Airborne had come up with the idea of leg bags. These bags contained extra ammunition, radios, machine gun tripods, medical gear, high explosives, and other equipment. They were to be attached to individual paratroopers by a quick-release mechanism and fastened to his parachute harness by a coiled 20-foot rope. When the chute opened, the trooper was supposed to hold the weight of the leg pack, pull its release to separate it from his leg, and let it down to the end of the rope. It would hit the ground before he did. In theory, the trooper would land on top of the bundle and not have to waste any time looking for his equipment. It seemed sensible, but no one in the American Airborne had ever jumped with a leg bag. The Yanks liked the idea of the thing and stuffed everything they could into those leg bags, mines, ammunition, broken-down Tommy guns, and more. The men threw their kits, parachutes, and leg bags into the waiting trucks, climbed in themselves, and were driven out to the waiting planes. "With that done," Winters wrote in his diary, "we went to work harnessing up. It's here that a good jump master can do the most for his men. Getting all that equipment on, tied down, make it comfortable and safe, then a parachute over the top calls for a lot of ingenuity and sales talk to satisfy the men that all's well." Dressed for battle, they sat under the wings of the planes, waiting. The nervousness increased. "This is the jump where your problems begin after you land," they told one another. It was the $10,000 jump. The men had $10,000 GI life insurance. Men struggled to their feet to go to the edge of the runway to relieve themselves, got back, sat down, and 2 minutes later repeated the process. Joe Toya recalled Lieutenant Meehan coming over to his plane to tell the men, "No prisoners. We're not taking any prisoners." At 2200, mount up. The jump masters pushed their men up the steps, each of them carrying at least 100 pounds, many 150 pounds. 101st Trooper spoke for all 13,400 men in the two airborne divisions when he got to the door of his C-47, turned to the east, and called, "Look out, Hitler! Here we come!" At 2310, the C-47s began roaring down the runway. When they reached 1,000 feet, they began to circle, getting into a V of V's formation. Three planes to each V. As they straightened out for France, most of the men found it difficult to stay awake. This was the effect of those pills. Through that night and into the next day, paratroopers had trouble staying awake. Joe Toya did fall asleep on his flight. "I was never so calm in all my life," he recalled. "Jesus, I was more excited on practice jumps." On Winter's plane, Private Joe Hogan tried to get a song going, but it was soon lost in the roar of the motors. On Gordon's plane, as on most, men were lost in their own thoughts or prayers. Private Wayne Sisk of West Virginia broke the mood by calling out, "Does anybody here want to buy a good watch?" That brought a roar of laughter and a lessening of the tension. Winters prayed the whole way over, prayed to live through it, prayed that he wouldn't fail. Every man, I think, had in his mind, "How will I react under fire?" With Lieutenant Schmidt in hospital, Sergeant Lipton was jump master on his plane. The pilot gave the paratroopers a choice. They could ride with the door off, giving them fresh air and a chance to get out if the plane was hit, or ride with the door in place, which would allow them to smoke. They chose to take it off, which allowed Lipton to lie on the floor with his head partly out the door. Most of the men were asleep, or nearly so, a consequence of the air sickness pills. As the C-47 crossed the channel, Lipton saw a sight no one had ever seen before, nor would anyone ever see again, a sight that every man who was in the air that night never forgot. The invasion fleet, 6,000 vessels strong, heading toward Normandy. Gordon Carson was with Lieutenant Welsh. As the plane crossed the channel, Welsh told the men near the front, "Look down!" They did, and all you could see was wakes. No one ever saw so many ships and boats before. Carson commented, "You had to be a little bit awed that you were part of a thing that was so much greater than you." At 0100 June 6th, the planes passed between the islands of Guernsey and Jersey. In his plane, the pilot called back to Winters, 20 minutes out." The crew chief removed the door of the plane, giving Winters, standing number one, a rush of fresh air and a view of the coast. "Stand up and hook up," he called out. The red light went on. At 0110, the planes passed over the coast and into a cloud bank. This caused the formation to break up. The lead V plowed straight ahead, but the Vs to each side veered off. The one to the right breaking away in that direction, the one on the left over the opposite way. This was the natural, inevitable reaction of the pilots who feared mid-air collisions. When they broke out of the cloud bank, which was only a mile or two across, every pilot was on his own. Only the lead pilots had the device that would lead them to the Pathfinder's Eureka signals. Pathfinders were specially trained volunteers who dropped in an hour ahead of the main body of troops to set up a radio beacon on the DZ to guide the lead plane. Easy's Pathfinders were Corporal Richard Wright and Private Carl Fenstermaker. With the formation gone, none of the others knew when or where to turn on the green light. They could only guess. Lost, bewildered, frightened, the pilots immediately had another worry. Anti-aircraft fire began coming up at them, blue, green, and red tracers indicating its path. It was light stuff, 20 and 40 millimeter. When it hit the planes, it made a sound like rocks being shaken in a tin can. On Harry Welsh's plane, some ack-ack came through exactly where he had been sitting a minute before. The pilots were supposed to slow down before turning on the green light, but as Gordon put it, here they were, thrust into the very jaws of this violence, and they had never had 1 minute of combat experience, so they were absolutely terrified, and rather than throttle down, they were kind of like a fellow thinking with his feet. They fought with that throttle, and they said, "My God, common sense will tell me the quicker I get out of here, the better chance I have of surviving. And that's unfortunate for the boys back there, but be that as it may, I'm getting out of here." So they increased speed, up to 150 miles per hour in many cases, and although they did not have the slightest idea where they were, except that it was somewhere over Normandy, they hit the green light. Men began shouting, "Let's go! Let's go!" They wanted out of those planes. Never had they thought they would be so eager to jump. Lipton's plane was bouncing and weaving, and the men were yelling, "Let's get out of here!" They were only 600 feet up, the 40-millimeter anti-aircraft tracers coming closer and closer. About the time the tracers were popping right past the tail of the plane, Lipton remembered, the green light went on. He leaped out. Private James Alley was number 2, Private Paul Rogers number 3. Alley had been told to throw his leg bag out the door and follow it into the night. He did as told and ended up flat on the floor with his head and half his body out of the plane, his bag dangling in the air about to pull him in half. Rogers, who was strong as a bull, threw him out the door and jumped right behind. Leo Boyle was the last man in the stick on his plane. There was this tremendous turbulence as the green light went on and the men began leaping out into the night. The plane lurched. Boyle was thrown violently down to the floor. The plane was flying at a tilt. Boyle had to reach up for the bottom of the door, pull himself to it, and roll out of the C-47 into the night. Tracers were everywhere. The lead plane in Stick 66, flown by Lieutenant Harold Capelluto, was hit with bullets going through it and out the top, throwing sparks. The plane maintained course and speed for a moment or two, then did a slow wing over to the right. Pilot Frank DeFlita, just behind, remembered that Capelluto's landing lights came on, and it appeared they were going to make it when the plane hit a hedgerow and exploded. It was the plane carrying Lieutenant Meehan, First Sergeant Evans, and the rest of the company headquarters section, including Sergeant Murray, who had held that long talk with Lipton about how to handle different combat situations. He never got to experience any of the possibilities he and Lipton had tried to visualize. Easy Company had not put one man into combat yet, and it had already lost platoon leader Schmitz, company commander Meehan, and its first sergeant. Private Rod Stroll was one of those so overloaded that he could not put on his reserve chute. I remember thinking, well, hell, if you need it and it doesn't open, it's going to be over in a hurry. And if you don't need it, you don't need it. His plane got hit and started going down. As his stick went out, the pilot and co-pilot came out with us. George Lutz was on Welsh's plane. He had barely made it, as in addition to all the regular gear, he was carrying a radio and batteries and had been unable to get into the plane until a bunch of Air Corps guys pushed him in. Once inside, he had turned to Welsh to say, "Lieutenant, you got me fifth man in the stick, and I'll never make it to the door." So Welsh had told him to change places with Private Roy Cobb. When the flak started, you could walk on it, Lutz remembered. Carson said, "We wanted to get out of there so damn bad it was unbelievable." Cobb called out, "I'm hit." "Can you stand up?" Welsh shouted. "I can't." "Unhook him," Welsh ordered. Mike Ranney unhooked Cobb from the static line. Private Rader recalled, "Cobb was some pissed. To have trained so hard for 2 years and not get to make the big jump was hell." Just then, the red light went on, flashed a second, and was hit by flak. "I had no way of telling anything," Welsh recalled. "So I said, go," and jumped. Lutz kicked his leg bag containing the radio and other equipment out the door and leaped into the night. Thus did 13,400 of America's finest youth, who had been training for this moment for 2 years, hurled themselves against Hitler's Fortress Europe. Chapter 5. Follow Me. Normandy, June 6, 1944. They jumped much too low, from planes that were flying much too fast. They were carrying far too much equipment and using an untested technique that turned out to be a major mistake. As they left the plane, the leg bags tore loose and hurtled to the ground, in nearly every case never to be seen again. Simultaneously, the prop blast tossed them this way and that. With all the extra weight and all the extra speed, when the chutes opened, the shock was more than they had ever experienced. Jumping at 500 feet and even less, they hit the ground within seconds of the opening of the chute. So they hit hard. The men were black and blue for a week or more afterward as a result. In a diary entry written a few days later, Lieutenant Winters tried to recreate his thoughts in those few seconds he was in the air.
"We're doing 150 miles per hour. Okay, let's go. Damn, there goes my leg pack and every bit of equipment I have. Watch it, boy, watch it. Geez, they're trying to pick me up with those machine guns. Slip, slip, trying to keep close to that leg pack. There it lands beside that hedge. Damn, that machine gun. There's a road. Trees, I hope I don't hit them. Thump! Well, that wasn't too bad. Now let's get out of this chute."
Bert Christensen jumped right behind Winters. "I don't think I did anything I had been trained to do, but suddenly I got a tremendous shock when my parachute opened. His leg bag broke loose, and it was history." He could hear a bell ringing in Sainte-Mère-Église and see a fire burning in town. "Machine gun bullets are gaining on me. I climb high into my risers. Christ, I'm headed for that line of trees. I'm descending too rapidly." As he passed over the trees, he pulled his legs up to avoid hitting them. A moment of terror seized me. 70 feet below and 20 feet to my left, a German quad-mounted 20-millimeter anti-aircraft gun is firing on the C-47s passing overhead. Lucky enough for Christensen, the German's line of fire was such that their backs were to him, and the noise was such that they never heard him hit, although he was only 40 yards or so away. Christensen cut himself out of his chute, pulled his six-shot revolver, and crouched at the base of an apple tree. He stayed still, moving only his eyes. Suddenly, I caught movement 10 yards away, a silhouette of a helmeted man approaching on all fours. I reached for my cricket and clicked it once. Click-clack. There was no response. The figure began to move toward me again. Christensen pointed a revolver at the man's chest and click-clacked again. The man raised his hands. "For Christ's sake, don't shoot!" It was Private Woodrow Robbins, Christensen's assistant gunner on the machine gun. "You dumb shit, what the hell's wrong with you? Why didn't you use your cricket?" Christensen demanded in a fierce whisper. "I lost the clicker part of the cricket." Slowly, the adrenaline drained from Christensen's brain, and the two men began backing away from the German position. They ran into Bull Randleman, who had a dead German at his feet. Randleman related that the moment he had gotten free of his chute, he had fixed his bayonet. Suddenly, a German came charging, his bayonet fixed. Randleman knocked the weapon aside, then impaled the German on his bayonet. "That Kraut picked the wrong guy to play bayonets with," Christensen remarked. Lieutenant Welsh's plane was at 250 feet at the most when he jumped. As he emerged from the C-47, another plane crashed immediately beneath him. He claimed that the blast from the explosion threw him up and to the side, and that saved my life. His chute opened just in time to check his descent, just enough to make the thump when he landed painful, but not fatal. Most of the men of Easy had a similar experience. Few of them were in the air long enough to orient themselves with any precision, although they could tell from the direction the planes were flying which was the way to the coast. They landed to hell and gone. The tight pattern within the DZ near Sainte-Marie-du-Mont that they had hoped for, indeed had counted on for quick assembly of the company, was so badly screwed up by the evasive action the pilots had taken when they hit the cloud bank that E Company men were scattered from Carentin to Ravanoville, a distance of 20 kilometers. The pathfinders, Richard Wright and Carl Fenstermaker, came down in the channel after their plane was hit. They were picked up by HMS Tartar, transferred to Air Sea Rescue, and taken to England. Private Tom Burgess came down near Santa Mère Église. Like most of the paratroopers that night, he did not know where he was. Low-flying planes roared overhead, tracers chasing after them, the sky full of descending Americans, indistinct and unidentifiable figures dashing or creeping through the fields, machine guns popping all around. After cutting himself out of his chute with his pocket knife, he used his cricket to identify himself to a lieutenant he did not know. Together, they started working their way toward the beach, hugging the ubiquitous hedgerows. Other troopers joined them, some from the 82nd, also badly scattered in the jump, some from different regiments of the 101st. They had occasional brief firefights with German patrols. The lieutenant made Burgess the lead scout. At first light, he came to a corner of the hedgerow he was following. A German soldier hiding in the junction of hedgerows rose up. Burgess didn't see him. The German fired downward. The bullet hit Burgess's cheekbone, went through the right cheek, fractured it, tore away the hinge of the jaw, came out the back of his neck. Blood squirted out his cheek, from the back of his neck and from his ear. He nearly choked to death. "I wanted to live," Burgess recalled 45 years later. "They had hammered into us that the main thing, if you get hit, is don't get excited. The worst thing you can do is go nuts." So he did his best to stay calm. The guys with him patched him up as best they could, got bandages over the wounds, and helped him into a nearby barn where he collapsed into the hay. He passed out. At midnight, a French farmer came out to the barn and sat there and held my hand. He even kissed my hand. He brought a bottle of wine. On the morning of June 7th, the farmer fetched two medics and lent them a horse-drawn cart, which they used to take Burgess down to the beach. He was evacuated to England, then back to the States. He arrived in Boston on New Year's Eve, 1944. He was on a strictly liquid diet until March 1945, when he took his first bite of solid food since his last meal at a pottery, June 5th, 1944.
Private Gordon hit hard. He had no idea where he was, but he had a definite idea of what he was determined to do first: assemble his machine gun. He tucked himself into a hedgerow and did the job. As he finished, I noticed this figure coming, and I realized it was John Eubanks from the way he walked. Shortly thereafter, Forrest Guth joined them. Another figure loomed in the dark. "Challenge him," Gordon to Eubanks. Before Eubanks could do so, the man called out, "Flash!" Eubanks forgot the countersign, Thunder, and forgot that the clicker was an alternative identification option, and instead said, "Lightning!" The man lobbed a grenade in on the three E Company men. They scattered. It went off. Fortunately, no one was hurt. The soldier disappeared, which was probably good for the group, as he was clearly much too nervous to trust. Gordon, Eubanks, and Guth started moving down a hedgerow toward the beach. They saw an American paratrooper running through the field, crouch, and jump into a drainage ditch. There was a three-quarters moon that night and few clouds over the land, so visibility was fair. Gordon told the others to stay still. He would check it out. He crept to the ditch, where I encountered these two eyeballs looking up at me and the muzzle of a pistol right in my face. "Gordon, is that you?" It was Sergeant Floyd Talbert. Now there were four. Together, they continued creeping, crawling, moving toward the beach. A half hour or so before first light, Guth heard what he was certain was the howling and whining of a convoy of 2.5-ton GI trucks going past. How could that be? The seaborne invasion hadn't even started, much less put truck convoys ashore. Some tremendous bursts coming from inland answered the question. The noise Guth heard came from the shells passing overhead, shells from the 16-inch naval guns on the battleships offshore. The E Company foursome joined up with a group from the 502nd that had just captured a German strongpoint in a large farm complex that dominated the crossroads north of the beach at Ravanoville. They spent the day defending the fortress from counterattacks. In the morning of D-Day plus one, they set out southward in search of their company. Jim Alley crashed into a wall behind a house, one of those French walls with broken glass embedded in the top. He was cut and bleeding in several places. He backed into the corner of a garden and was in the process of cutting himself out of the harness when someone grabbed his arm. It was a young woman standing in the bushes. "Me American," Alley whispered. "Go vay, go vay." She went back into her house. Alley found his leg pack, got his gear together, 13 rounds of 60-millimeter mortar ammunition, 4 landmines, ammunition for his M1, hand grenades, food, the base plate for the mortar and other stuff, climbed to the top of the wall and drew machine gun fire. It was about a foot low. He got covered with plaster before he could fall back into the garden. He laid down to think about what to do. He ate one of his Hershey bars and decided to go out the front way. Before he could move, the young woman came out of the house, looked at him, and proceeded out the front gate. Alley figured, "This is it. I'll make my stand here." Soon she returned. A soldier stepped through the gate after her. I had my gun on him, and he had his on me. They recognized each other. He was from the 505th. "Where the hell am I?" Alley demanded. He was told, "Sainte Mère Église." He joined up with the 505th. At about daybreak, he ran into Paul Rogers and Earl McClung from Easy. They spent the day, and the better part of the week that followed, fighting with the 505th. All across the peninsula, throughout the night and into the day of D-Day, paratroopers were doing the same, fighting skirmishes, joining together in ad hoc units, defending positions, harassing the Germans, trying to link up with their units. This was exactly what they had been told to do. Their training and confidence thus overcame what could have been a disaster and thereby turned the scattered drop from a negative into a plus. The Germans, hearing reports of action here, there, everywhere, grossly overestimated the number of troopers they were dealing with, and therefore reacted in a confused and hesitant manner. Winters had come down on the edge of Mère Sainte-Église. He could see the big fire near the church, hear the church bell calling out the citizens to fight the fire. He could not find his leg bag. The only weapon he had was his bayonet, stuck into his boot. His first thought was to get away from the machine gun and small arms fire in the church square. Just as he started off, a trooper landed close by. Winters helped him out of his chute, got a grenade from him, and said, "Let's go back and find my leg bag." The trooper hesitated. "Follow me," Winters ordered, and started off. A machine gun opened up on them. "To hell with the bag," Winters said. He set out to the north to bypass Sainte-Mère-Église before turning east to the coast. In a few minutes, he saw some figures and used his cricket. He got a reassuring double click-clack from Sergeant Lipton. Lipton had landed in a walled-in area behind the Hôtel de Ville, City Hall, in Sainte-Mère-Église, a block from the church. Like Winters, he had lost his weapons when he lost his leg bag. In his musette bag, he had 2 grenades and a demolitions kit, plus his trench knife. He climbed over a gate and worked his way down the street, away from the church and the fire. At the edge of town, there was a low, heavy concrete signpost with the name of the village on it. Lipton put his face up close to the letters and moved along them, reading them one by one, until he knew that the sign read Sainte-Mère-Église. Paratroopers were coming down around him. Not wanting to get shot by a nervous American, when he saw 2 coming down close together, he ran right under them. When they hit the ground, before they could even think about shooting, Lipton was already talking to them. They were from the 82nd Airborne, 10 kilometers away from where they were supposed to be. Sergeant Guarnieri joined up, along with Don Malarkey, Joe Toya, and Popeye Wynn. A few minutes later, Lipton ran into Winters. "I saw a road sign down there," Lipton reported. "Sainte-Mère-Église." "Good," Winters answered. "I know where that is. I can take it from here." He set out at the head of the group. Objective, Sainte-Marie-du-Mont. They joined a bunch from the 502nd. About 0300 hours, they spotted a German patrol, 4 wagons coming down the road. They set up an ambush, and there Guarnieri got his first revenge for his brother as he blasted the lead wagons. The other 2 got away, but E Company took a few prisoners. A German machine gun opened fire on the group. When it did, the prisoners tried to jump the Americans. Guarnieri shot them with his pistol. "No remorse," he said when describing the incident 47 years later. "No pity. It was as easy as stepping on a bug. After a pause, he added, "We are different people now than we were then." At about 0600 hours, they ran into Captain Jerry Gross of D Company and 40 of his men. They joined forces to head toward Sainte-Marie-du-Mont, some 8 kilometers southeast. In a few minutes, they ran into the 2nd Battalion staff with about 40 more men. Winters found an M1, then a revolver, belt, canteen, and lots of ammunition. So I was feeling ready to fight, especially after I bummed some food from one of the boys. Lipton found a carbine. The others armed themselves. As the Americans moved toward Sainte-Marie-du-Mont, so did the commander of the German unit defending the area, Colonel Frederick von der Heydt of the 6th Parachute Regiment. He was an experienced soldier, having been in the German army since the mid-1920s and having led men in combat in Poland, France, Russia, Crete, and North Africa. Colonel von der Heydt was the senior German officer present, as the division commanders were in Rennes on the Seine River for a war game. He had one battalion in and around Sainte-Marie-Église, another near Sainte-Marie-du-Mont, the third in Carentan. All his platoons were standing, too. Some were trying to engage the Americans, but confusion caused by reports of landings here, there, seemingly everywhere, had made concerted counterattacks impossible. Colonel von der Heydt wanted to see for himself. He drove his motorcycle from Carentan to Sainte-Marie-du-Mont, where he climbed to the top of the church steeple, 50 or 60 meters above the ground. There he had a magnificent view of Utah Beach. What he saw quite took his breath away. "All along the beach," he recalled in a 1991 interview, "were these small boats, hundreds of them, each disgorging 30 or 40 armed men. Behind them were the warships, blasting away with their huge guns, more warships in one fleet than anyone had ever seen before." Around the church, in the little village, and beyond in the green fields crisscrossed by hedgerows, all was quiet. The individual firefights of the night had tapered off with the coming of the light. Von der Heydt could see neither American nor German units. Climbing down from the steeple, the colonel drove his motorcycle a couple of kilometers north to Brécourt Manor, where the German artillery had a battery of 405-millimeter cannon dug in and camouflaged. There were no artillerymen around. Evidently, they had scattered in the night after the airborne landings began. Von der Heydt roared back to Carentan, where he ordered his 1st Battalion to occupy and hold Sainte-Marie-du-Mont and Brécourt, and to find some artillerymen to get that battery working. It was perfectly placed to lob shells on the landing craft at Utah Beach and to engage the warships out in the channel. By this time, about 0700, E Company consisted of 2 light machine guns, 1 bazooka, no ammunition, 1 60-millimeter mortar, 9 riflemen, and 2 officers. As the 2nd Battalion moved into a group of houses in a tiny village called Le Grand Chemin, just 3 kilometers or so short of Sainte-Marie-du-Mont, it drew heavy fire from up front. The column stopped. Winters and his men sat down to rest. 10 or 15 minutes later, Battalion S1 Lieutenant George Lavinson, formerly of E Company, came walking down the road. "Winters," he said, "they want you up front." Captain Hester, S3, and Lieutenant Nixon, S2, both close friends of Winters, told him there was a 4-gun battery of German 105-millimeter cannon a few hundred meters across some hedgerows and open fields, opposite a large French farmhouse called Brécourt Manor. Intelligence had not spotted the cannon, as they were dug into the hedgerow, connected by an extensive trench system covered by brush and trees. There was a 50-man platoon of infantry defending the position, part of Colonel von der Heydt's 1st Battalion. The cannon had just gone into action, firing on Utah Beach, some 5 or 6 kilometers to the northeast. The 2nd Battalion was less than 100 men strong at that point. Lieutenant Colonel Strayer had responsibilities in all 4 directions from Le Grand Chemin. He was trying to build his battalion up to somewhere near its full strength of 600 men and to defend from counterattacks. He could only afford to send 1 company to attack the German battery. Hester told Winters to take care of that battery. It was 0830. Captain Sobel was about to get a little revenge on Hitler. The U.S. Army was about to get a big payoff from its training and equipment investment. The American people were about to get their reward for having raised such fine young men. The company that Sobel and the army and the country had brought into being and trained for this moment was going into action. Winters went to work instinctively and immediately. He told the men of E Company to drop all the equipment they were carrying except weapons, ammunition, and grenades. He explained that the attack would be a quick frontal assault supported by a base of fire from different positions as close to the guns as possible. He set up the two machine guns to give covering fire as he moved the men forward to their jump-off positions. The field in which the cannon were located was irregular in shape, with seven acute angles in the hedgerow surrounding it. This gave Winters an opportunity to hit the Germans from different directions. Winters placed his machine guns, manned by Private John Plesha and Walter Hendricks, on one gun, Cleveland Petty and Joe Liepgott on the other, along the hedge leading up to the objective, with instructions to lay down covering fire. As Winters crawled forward to the jump-off position, he spotted a German helmet. The man was moving down the trench, crouched over, with only his head above ground. Winters took aim with his M1 and squeezed off two shots, killing the Jerry. Winters told Lieutenant Compton to take Sergeants Guarnieri and Malarkey, get over to the left, crawl through the open field, get as close to the first gun in the battery as possible, and throw grenades into the trench. He sent Sergeants Lipton and Ranney out along the hedge to the right, alongside a copse of trees, with orders to put a flanking fire into the enemy position. Winters would lead the charge straight down the hedge. With him were Privates Gerald Lorraine of Regimental HQ, he was Colonel Sink's Jeep driver, and Popeye Wynn, and Corporal Joe Toya. Here the training paid off. "We fought as a team without standout stars," Lipton said. "We were like a machine. We didn't have anyone who leaped up and charged a machine gun. We knocked it out or made it withdraw by maneuver and teamwork or mortar fire. We were smart. There weren't many flashy heroics. We had learned that heroics was the way to get killed without getting the job done. And getting the job done was more important." When Rennie and Lipton moved out along the hedge, they discovered they could not see the German positions because of low brush and ground cover. Lipton decided to climb a tree, but there were none of sufficient size to allow him to fire from behind a trunk. The one he picked had many small branches. He had to sit precariously on the front side facing the Germans, exposed if they looked his way, balancing on several branches. About 75 meters away, he could see about 15 of the enemy, some in the trenches, others prone in the open, firing toward E Company, too intent on the activity to their front to notice Lipton. Lipton was armed with a carbine he had picked up during the night. He fired at a German in the field. The enemy soldier seemed to duck. Lipton fired again. His target did not move. Not certain that the carbine had been zeroed in, Lipton aimed into the dirt just under the man's head and squeezed off another round. The dirt flew up right where he aimed. Lipton now knew that the carbine sights were right and his first shot had killed the man. He began aiming and firing as fast as he could from his shaky position. Lieutenant Compton was armed with a Thompson submachine gun that he had picked up during the night. He got it from a lieutenant from D Company who had broken his leg in the jump. Using all his athletic skill, he successfully crawled through the open field to the hedge, Guarnieri and Malarkey alongside him. The Germans were receiving fire from the machine gun to their left, from Lipton and Ranney to their rear, and from Winters' group in their front. They did not notice Compton's approach. When he reached the hedge, Compton leaped over and threw it. He had achieved complete surprise and had the German gun crew and infantry dead in his sights, but when he pulled the trigger on the borrowed Tommy gun, nothing happened. It was jammed. At that instant, Winters called, "Follow me," and the assault team went tearing down the hedge toward Compton. Simultaneously, Guarnieri leaped into the trench beside Compton. The German crew at the first gun under attack from three directions fled. The infantry retreated with them, tearing down the trench away from Compton, Guarnieri, and Malarkey. The Easy Company men began throwing grenades at the retreating enemy. Compton had been an All-American catcher on the UCLA baseball team. The distance to the fleeing enemy was about the same as from home plate to second base. Compton threw his grenade in a straight line, no arch, and it hit a German in the head as it exploded. He, Malarkey, and Guarnieri then began lobbing grenades down the trench. Winters and his group were with them by now, firing their rifles, throwing grenades, shouting, their blood pumping, adrenaline giving them Superman strength. Wynne was hit in the butt and fell down in the trench, hollering over and over, "I'm sorry, Lieutenant, I goofed off, I'm sorry." A German potato masher sailed into the trench, everyone dived to the ground.
"Joe, look out!" Winters called to Toya.
The grenade had landed between his legs as he lay face down. Toya flipped over. The potato masher hit his rifle and tore up the stock as it exploded. But he was uninjured. "If it wasn't for Winters," Toya said in 1990, "I'd be singing high soprano today." Winters tossed some grenades down the trench, then went tearing after the retreating gun crew. Private Lorraine and Sergeant Guarnieri were with him. Three of the enemy infantry started running cross-country, away toward Brecourt Manor.
"Get 'em!" Winters yelled.
Lorraine hit one with his Tommy gun. Winters aimed his M1, squeezed, and shot his man through the back of his head. Guarnieri missed the third Jerry, but Winters put a bullet in his back. Guarnieri followed that up by pumping the wounded man full of lead from his Tommy gun. The German kept yelling, "Help! Help!" Winters told Malarkey to put one through his head. A fourth German jumped out of the trench about 100 yards up the hedge. Winters saw him, lay down, took careful aim, and killed him. 15 or 20 seconds had passed since he had led the charge. Easy had taken the first gun. Winters' immediate thought was that there were plenty of Germans further up the trench, and they would be counterattacking soon. He flopped down, crawled forward in the trench, came to a connecting trench, looked down, and sure enough, there were two of them setting up a machine gun, getting set to fire. I got in the first shot and hit the gunner in the hip. The second caught the other boy in the shoulder. Winters put Toya and Compton to firing toward the next gun, sent three other men to look over the captured cannon, and three to cover to the front. By this time, Lipton had scrambled out of his tree and was working his way to Winters. Along the way, he stopped to sprinkle some sulfur powder on Wynne's butt and slap on a bandage. Wynne continued to apologize for goofing off. Warrant Officer Andrew Hill from Regimental HQ came up behind Lipton.
"Where's Regimental HQ?" he shouted.
"Back that way," Lipton said, pointing to the rear. Hill raised his head to look. A bullet hit him in the forehead and came out behind his ear, killing him instantly. After that, all movement was confined to the trench system and in a crouch, as German machine gun fire was nearly continuous, cutting right across the top of the trench. But Malarkey saw one of the Germans killed by Winters about 30 yards out in the field, with a black case attached to his belt. Malarkey thought it must be a Luger. He wanted it badly, so he ran out into the field, only to discover that it was a leather case for the 105mm sight. Winters was yelling at him, "Idiot, this place is crawling with crowds. Get back here." Evidently, the Germans thought Malarkey was a medic. In any case, the machine gunners did not turn on him until he started running back to the trench. With bullets kicking up all around him, he dived under the 105. Winters was at the gun, wanting to disable it, but without a demolition kit. Lipton came up and said he had one in his musette bag, which was back where the attack began. Winters told him to go get it. Time for the second gun, Winters thought to himself. He left three men behind to hold the first gun, then led the other five on a charge down the trench, throwing grenades ahead of them, firing their rifles. They passed the two Jerrys at the machine gun who had been wounded by Winters and made them prisoners. The gun crew at the second gun fell back. Easy took it with only one casualty. With the second gun in his possession and running low on ammunition, Winters sent back word for the four machine gunners to come forward. Meanwhile, six German soldiers decided they had had enough. They came marching down the connecting trench to the second gun, hands over their heads, calling out, "No make dead! No make dead!" Private John D. Hall of A Company joined the group. Winters ordered a charge on the third gun. Hall led the way and got killed, but the gun was taken. Winters had three of his men secure it. With 11 men, he now controlled three 105s. At the second gun site, Winters found a case with documents and maps showing the positions of all the guns and machine gun positions throughout the Cotentin Peninsula. He sent the documents and maps back to battalion. along with the prisoners and a request for more ammunition and some reinforcements, because we were stretched out too much for our own good. Using grenades, he set about destroying the gun crew's radio, telephone, and rangefinders. Captain Hester came up, bringing 3 blocks of TNT and some phosphorus incendiary grenades. Winters had a block dropped down the barrel of each of the 3 guns, followed by a German potato masher grenade. This combination blew out the breeches of the guns like half-peeled bananas. Lipton was disappointed when he returned with his demolition kit to discover that it was not needed. Reinforcements arrived, 5 men led by Lieutenant Ronald Spears of D Company. One of them, Rusty Hooch of F Company, raised up to throw a grenade into the gun positions and was hit several times across the back and shoulders by a burst from a machine gun. He died instantly. Spears led an attack on the final gun, which he took and destroyed, losing 2 men killed. Winters then ordered a withdrawal, because the company was drawing heavy machine gun fire from the hedges near Breakwood Manor, and with the guns destroyed, there was no point to holding the position. The machine gunners pulled back first, followed by the riflemen. Winters was last. As he was leaving, he took a final look down the trench. Here was this one wounded Jerry we were leaving behind trying to put a machine gun on us again, so I drilled him clean through the head. It was 11:30. About 3 hours had passed since Winters had received the order to take care of those guns. With 12 men, what amounted to a squad, later reinforced by Spears and the others, Company E had destroyed a German battery that was looking straight down Causeway No. 2 and onto Utah Beach. That battery had a telephone line running to a forward observer who was in a pillbox located at the head of Causeway No. 2. He had been calling shots down on the 4th Infantry as it unloaded. The significance of what Easy Company had accomplished cannot be judged with any degree of precision, but it surely saved a lot of lives and made it much easier, perhaps even made it possible in the first instance, for tanks to come inland from the beach. It would be a gross exaggeration to say that Easy Company saved the day at Utah Beach, but reasonable to say that it made an important contribution to the success of the invasion. Winter's casualties were 4 dead, 2 wounded. He and his men had killed 15 Germans, wounded many more, and taken 12 prisoners. In short, they had wiped out the 50-man platoon of elite German paratroops defending the guns and scattered the gun crews. In an analysis written in 1985, Lipton said, "The attack was a unique example of a small, well-led assault force overcoming and routing a much larger defending force in prepared positions. It was the high morale of the E Company men, the quickness and audacity of the frontal attack, and the fire into their positions from several different directions that demoralized the German forces and convinced them that they were being hit by a much larger force." There were other factors, including the excellent training the company had received, and that this was their baptism of fire. The men had taken chances they would not take in the future. Lipton said he would never have climbed that tree and so exposed himself had he been a veteran. "But we were so full of fire that day." "You don't realize your first time," Guarnieri said. "I'd never, never do again what I did that morning. Compton would not have burst through that hedge had he been experienced." "I was sure I would not be killed," Lipton said. "I felt that if a bullet was headed for me, it would be deflected or I would move." Paul Fussell, in wartime, writes that the soldier going into combat the first time thinks to himself, "It can't happen to me. I am too clever, agile, well-trained, good-looking, beloved, tightly laced, etc." That feeling soon gives way to, "It can happen to me, and I'd better be more careful. I can avoid the danger by watching more prudently the way I take cover, dig in, expose my position by firing my weapon, keep extra alert at all times, etc." In his analysis, Winters gave credit to the Army for having prepared him so well for this moment. "My apogee," he called it. He had done everything right, from scouting the position to laying down a base of covering fire to putting his best men, Compton, Guarnieri, and Malarkey, in one group
Lipton and Ranny in the other, on the most challenging missions, two leading the charge personally at exactly the right moment. Winters felt that if Sobel had been in command, he would have led all 13 men on a frontal assault and lost his life, along with the lives of most of the men. Who can say he was wrong about that? But then who can say that the men of Easy would have had the discipline, the endurance? They had been marching since 0130 after a night of little or no real sleep. They were battered and bruised from the opening shock and the hard landing. Or the weapons skills to carry off this fine feat of arms, had it not been for Sobel. Sink put Winters in for the Congressional Medal of Honor. Only one man per division was to be given that ultimate medal for the Normandy campaign. In the 101st, it went to Lieutenant Colonel Robert Cole for leading a bayonet charge. Winters received the Distinguished Service Cross. Compton, Guarnieri, Lorraine, and Toya got the Silver Star. Lipton, Malarkey, Ranny, Liebgott, Hendricks, Plesha, Petty, and Wynne got Bronze Stars. A month or so later, Winters was called into Regimental HQ. Sink, Strayer, and the staff were sitting in a tent. At the head of a table was SLA Marshall, the Army's combat historian. The atmosphere around the table was electric, Winters remembered. Those West Pointers would have killed to have the opportunity I had to be sitting in the chair across from Marshall. "Okay, Lieutenant," Marshall said. "Tell me what you did out there on D-Day. You took that battery of 105s, didn't you?" "Yes, sir, that's right." "Tell me how you did it." "Well, sir, I put down a base of fire. We moved in under the base of fire and we took the first gun. And then we put down another base of fire, and we moved to the second gun, and the third gun, and the fourth gun." "Okay, anything else?" "No, sir, that's basically it." As a junior officer facing all that brass, Winters figured he had better not lay it on too thick. So he made it sound like a routine training problem.
This is the end of Disc 3.